C1A. Number 14A.
Now we come to the tone of principle in a tone in Euclid. And here again, let's see the irresistible sequence in the subject. He first in mind, mind impels the seeking thought to atone with mind, and therefore to sacrifice one's own concept, one's own mind. Doing that, the question then arises as a second step, well, is that attitude your only God? Are you willing to sacrifice your own mind for the divine mind? If so, then turn away from the false God and turn alone to the imperishable things of spirit. That's how she ended the second step. And if we turn away from a material concept as the center and circumference of our being, and turn inwardly, constantly, and sincerely to the imperishable things of spirit, we always will find temptations and resist. Animal magnetism, the serpent, will always come in and try to hold us back. And so it's always that which says, well, if I'm constant in my turning to the spiritual, then nothing can draw me back anymore. And I have the third subject, which shows that if I fulfill, in the measure as I fulfill the second step, and my whole heart reaches out for a spiritual purpose, then that spiritual purpose is strong enough in me to go forward in spite of everything that tries to hold me back. And there comes in that sense that something is born in us which is perseverance, which is definite, which is firm and calm. And so at the end of that subject, Mrs. Eddy shows that then we have a constant, firm, unshakable trust, speaks there of trustworthiness, a trust in something which is worthwhile. And she says there in the tone of soulless love that then with that trust we can work out our own salvation against fear and trembling, or in the midst of fear and trembling, and so be firm and calm. But in what? But in what? Up to this point, only the way of that constancy has been shown. But now, in principle, she shows that we have to be constant in the implication of principle and its atonement. And therefore, she... That's only the recorder that makes that noise, but we try our best to prevent it. So, we must know in what we trust. We only have seen the way of trusting up to now, is that the spiritual steps to be taken in order to get the firm, constant, irresistible, unshakable, balanced trust in God. But what is that God? And so in the fourth subject, she now explains the principle of atonement. She explains now what the principle of atonement implies in itself. Because, and you see how necessary this is, that we can be constant and firm with a purpose or towards an aim which may not be divine, which may be theological. And so here she shows that all what she has shown through the first three subjects must be directed to a scientific sense of atonement and not to a theological sense of atonement. Because we know from experience, if we take a very good religionist, a very sincere religionist, we could say to him, or we could say of him, that he is very perseverant and very constant, very sincere and very honest in the doctrine of atonement which theology presents to him. And so all his good qualities would be, from our standpoint, misdirected to a system of atonement which is not divine. So here we come to the principle of the atonement, to the content, to the constituent, so to say, of what atonement is, especially in comparison to what the theological sense of atonement means. So you may have found too, anyway I hope so, in your study, that in this fourth subject, she presents the spiritual scientific system of atonement, and which consists of a Eucharist. Always the atonement is always coupled with a Eucharist, is always coupled with the giving up of its counterfeit, namely of giving up that theological system or doctrine of atonement. And all through the subtones you have found that the theological concept of atonement is compared with the scientific sense of atonement. We'll go through them very soon. But also, you have felt in that passage, in that fourth part, that she shows that if we atone, if we use that first, second, and third subject to atone with a scientific sense of atonement, with a spiritually scientific system of atonement, that she shows that if we atone with that, that has spiritual power. You know, the principle has spiritual power. But we say that. Now, just take this as another example to illustrate something which is of a general nature. See, we have learned through the study of the synonymous terms and through looking at other people's notes and lists of notes and so on, that principle is characterized by spiritual power. And whenever we wanted to demonstrate spiritual power, we were thinking of principle. But that doesn't do a trick. I don't see why it should do a trick. I think it would be wrong if it would do a trick. Because just thinking of a word in connection with another word, that should do a trick, I can't see that should be right. That should be God, life stuff. I just can't see it. Well, I don't say with that, and I must make that clear, I don't say that all that work was not right. It was right, and is right, and will be right. But it is from the standpoint of mind, of clarifying to our thoughts and bringing some clarification and system and classification into our thoughts in order to get the tool with which to work. But to see that principle is spiritual power, and principle is spiritual power, but not because we know that principle is spiritual power, it is spiritual power. It is only then spiritual power if through the birth of divine qualities and divine facts we have atoned with principle, and with the principle sense of atonement, then it has power. Well, what does it mean to atone with the principle sense of atonement? Well, that's what we have seen through the first section and first subject. Whenever, or in the measure as we have devoted our whole inward mental attitude of clinging and making a covenant with God, to be one with God, and having that wonderful Christ sent in us, which says, then I disidentify, disunify, if you can say that, I break the covenant with mortal mind, I break the covenant with the human mind, and I just build up the one covenant with the divine mind. If secondly, I begin to have that sense of love and adoration and valuation and affection and gratitude for the spiritual, as shown in prayer, that I begin to stick to the spiritual and work towards the spiritual, and therefore have inwardly shown by exemplification here and then by constant sacrifice that I am willing to turn away from the material beliefs, that I am willing to put first things first, that inwardly I have exemplified day in and day out, year in and year out, that I am willing to make the spiritual the center and circumference of my being, that the spiritual is the center from which I imply and deduce everything. Well, in the measure as I have done that and have as a third point stuck to that and not let be sidetracked by any temptation, by difficulties, by other influences, if I have shown that unity to be definite, unbreakable, unshakable, if I have done that, then something in me has grown in the spiritual stature that I see that unity with principle is a principled unity, and therefore takes part of the nature of this principle. Work out your own salvation, and in the measures it says that we work out that salvation is the demand of life and love, and for this end God worketh with you. Then, if in soul we have proved through our inward steadfastness that we really mean business with this divine order, then God begins to work with me. Then the whole attitude ripens to the point where principle begins to prove itself to me as spiritual power. So when I say principle is spiritual power, I must see what is principle. Principle isn't the word. Principle was my unity with principle, my principled attitude, first in prayer, and then the exemplification in spite of difficulties that I stick to this unity in thought and life and in every way. That's being principle, and that's a spiritual power. Not words, not thinkings have spiritual power. Thinkings have only mental power, and it ranges from mesmerism, animal magnetism, to benevolent influence and benevolent magnetism. But it isn't God, it isn't spiritual reality. The mental and the spiritual must be distinguished properly. So here she shows that at that point where we have inwardly given birth to atonement through the first, second and third stage, that then we have bound ourselves to a scientific meaning of atonement and not to a theological meaning of atonement, and being bound to a scientific meaning of atonement, we take part of the spiritual power which is embedded in that unity with Prince. Therefore, you may have seen in question 43 how over and over again Mrs. Eddy says that this unity has the power of demonstration. How she speaks here now suddenly a lot about healing and about the arm of the Lord, the spiritual power, about proof, about the great proof, and so on, about demonstration, about divine power, working and deed and efficacy and authority over sin, sickness and death. You have seen that, you have felt that. And asking ourselves, well, on what basis was that possible? On what foundation does this subject build? You got in question 44 certainly for yourself quite a lot of comparisons where she shows, well, that which relies on something divinely fundamental, like the original text of the Bible, like the revelation of the Lord, like divine principle and the divine principle of all beings, the signs of all beings, that has spiritual power. There's all the other foundations which she indicates, like human beliefs, hierarchies, passion of men, theological views, popular opinions, erudite theology, spiritualism, and so on, that they have no power, that they just don't have spiritual power. In other words, she shows that if we accept the scientific sense of atoning, of becoming one, of making a covenant with God, a unity with God, that empowers us. Only that. It doesn't empower us if we learn ideas of mind and learn ideas of spirit and learn ideas of soul. We just don't. It's atoning. It's a spiritual birth which must go on in the new man which has spiritual power. And perhaps you have also noticed how over and over again she shows that basing ourselves on the scientific foundation of atonement, that gives true power, the power of demonstration. And what does it demonstrate? She always shows that it demonstrates a new sense of life, a new sense of life. Demonstrates something living, demonstrates something which is really of the nature of true life. I just indicate that because later on we will see how important that is. So we could epitomize really this passage as seeing that principle demands adherence to the spiritual, scientific constituents of atonement, and that this obedience to the scientific sense of atonement has the power of demonstration. The subtone naturally must elaborate that tone, must elaborate what is implied by the spiritual scientific constituents of atonement. And it's very interesting and very easy subject, I think, for us all, because somehow it's a subject which we have all lived through a great extent. You see, she first says, well, what constitutes now this system of atonement? She says, well, it's the acquaintance. If you acquaint yourself, you atone your mind with something. It's acquaintance with a knowledge of the original text of the Bible, an unpolluted sense of the Bible, which is not polluted by human beliefs and by priests and by theology and so on. And we know that. We just know that. We have experienced that so wonderfully, that if we take the original text of the Bible and read the Bible as it is, and if we really can put away our theological views about, they always bring a new life. They always give us a new sense of strength and power. It's only when our old theological or moral sense creeps in that they are flat and, flat? That they are meaningless, that they are ordinary, that they are, you know what I mean. At the moment, really, one puts away on any sense of theological view, just takes the text as it is, unpreconceived, the text of Revelation, and let Revelation speak to it, they certainly begin come powering us. And then she goes on and says, and then comes the important point, spirit, that atonement demands that a spiritual and not the theological concept of atonement, a spiritual interpretation of that text and not a theological conception of it. It is there where she says that we must see that this text of the Bible has a spiritual interpretation. And only if we see spiritual interpretation that it has the power of demonstration. But that theology has taken the text and given to it a human, a material, a literal interpretation, and therefore has taken the spiritual power out of it, has taken away the power of which Revelation gives. And so it goes on to the third soul and shows that in the measure as we atone in that atonement demands a spiritual offering, and that we, as in the measure as we begin, I would say like this, that in the measure as we begin the spiritual interpretation of the Bible, that it has the power in itself, as she says, to cleanse from sin. Whereas if we take it literally, like the blood offering of Jesus, that it has no power in. Theological atonement says the blood of Jesus has atoned for us. And she says, well, if you take that, but that doesn't cleanse us from sin. It has no power. It has no power of reformation. It has no power to change us. But he says that if we take the spiritual meaning of the revelation of the original text and are willing to take that and offer make the sacrifice of a theological interpretation, that spiritual meaning has the power of soul that it cleanses us. You all have experience that. Through the talks of Mr. Dawley on the Bible, we all have experience. At the moment we have taken the text of the Bible in its revelatory sense. Revelatory, can you say that? Revelatory sense. At the moment we have taken that, in that sense, something in us has been touched, and we have begun to see there is a spiritual meaning in it, and there is not a theological meaning in it, and the literal meaning in it is of no value, has no substance. And in the measure as we have taken the spiritual meaning, principle of soul, spirit, something began to happen. Principle of soul had power, cleanse us, reform us, made a new creature of us. Anyway, it gave us new direction, gave us a new purpose in life, gave us lots of things. It changed them. It had the power of changing. And so she comes to principle as principle and says, well, it isn't our adoration for Jesus and for a personal teacher that can do something to atonement, that has power. Theology preaches adoration of Mary and adoration of Jesus. All the emotional love we have for him, she says, that doesn't do a trick. Says, what does do a trick is that atonement demands the exemplification of our obedience to that teacher. That is, it demands that we exemplify that what the teacher commanded, what the teacher really taught, and not obedience to his person, or an admiration of his person, of his personality. And so principle says, well, atonement demands that we exemplify the obedience to what the teacher has taught and shown, and not that we adore his personality. Well, I think to a great extent we have experienced that with John Dawley. I mean, those who have taken John Dawley, who has a wonderful human character and so on, personal, they had missed the track. They fell away when he was no more there. And those who have seen that it isn't John Dawley, that it is science interpreting itself to our age and giving us the key to science, and have seen that, they just sit and went on, proving, trying to prove us to the best extent, trying to be obedient, being obedient to the best extent, no matter if John is here or if he's gone. That's atonement. Atoning with what principle teaches and not atoning to what somebody teaches about. And so she comes to principle as life, where she gives the sense that atonement demands individual experiences. Always when it comes to the subtone of life, it's always the individual experience that must be experienced. Where she says that no individual experience will be spared for everyone. That we cannot atone, as theology tells us, through the experience of Jesus. That Jesus went through all the experience necessary, and through his experience we are atoned. No. That he only showed us that we can do it and how to do it, and that it's possible that one can do it. But he left it to each one of us to do it too. And so know what atones us, what brings us further, what pushes us on the way of life. That which enables us to make progress on the way of life is really that we accept these experiences, are willing to go through experience and go through them, and are glad to go through them and don't murmur about them. That's atonement. Then we atone really with the principle of life, which says you can't go further unless you leave your baggage behind. That's the experience. Experiences in life are nothing else than the unwillingness to lay down our baggage of life, the human baggage and the material baggage of life. If we were willing, completely willing, to have but one life, the divine life, we wouldn't have any sad experience and sad experience. We wouldn't, because divine life is without us. So experiences are necessary, and we can't shun to go through the experience. Is that English? Huh? No, I'm much better than what I think. See, the thing is that atonement says take the experience. They are necessary. They are in the law of atonement. They are in the law of atonement that we have experience, because they are the method through which we are forced to give up the baggage and the heavy baggage of the human life and material life. And so they serve a divine purpose.